everybody. My name is Eli Lake of the New Republic and, of course, the Washington Times, and I'm here with Dr. Dre of the rap group NWA. So you're about to now witness the power of street knowledge. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Dre.
Let me correct that slightly. I am Daniel Dresner.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I ambushed you there, Dan.
You James O'Keefe wannabe you. I'm Daniel Dresner. I'm a professor at the Fletcher School of International Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. I blog at foreignpolicy.com, and I am the author of the just-released Theories of International Politics and Zombies.
Very good.
Yes.
And I would have said that, and I've said that before, but I just like calling you Dr. Dre.
That was actually one of my nicknames when I was playing Ultimate Frisbee, if that makes you feel better. So, you know.
There you go. So let's start off. We're going to include a piece on the right-hand side of the screen, my latest piece for the New Republic on a history of U.S. outreach for two offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood and political Islam in general. And I tried in the space of 2,000 words to capture exactly kind of what the U.S. has been trying to do with what, for lack of a better word, we would call Islamists since the 1979 revolution. And here's what I've come up with, Dan. The million-dollar question is there a way to get groups that, you know, a movement that says its goal is to replace civil law with Quranic or religious law, to respect the limitations of democracy, to lose elections peacefully, and to be a part of a kind of pluralistic society and political culture? And in this respect, I conclude that I don't know the answer to that question, but every time they've tried to sort of establish a dialogue with these offshoots, the U.S. diplomats and intelligence analysts and others were generally foiled by allied dictatorships in countries like Egypt and Tunisia because the state-to-state relations, the client, strongman in these cases, did not like us talking to Islamist opposition.
No, I read the piece. First of all, I have to give a shout-out because it appears that the first person to come up with this idea in the State Department was, in fact, my current boss, Steve Bosworth, who is the now the dean of the Fletcher School and the administration's envoy to North Korea. At the time, as you said, was the ambassador to Tunisia, and after the 79 revolution said, gee, you know, maybe we should start talking to these people rather than getting blindsided by this. So that was nice to see. It was striking, and it was striking to read in the piece the extent to which the sort of local authoritarian leaders could basically put the clamps down on any U.S. effort to actually engage these people, which I was surprised by. I didn't realize that. I mean, in the abstract, it would not be surprising that you would see authoritarians do that. What's surprising is that the U.S. government complied so often.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. It's that I think that in the United States, we tended to look at our relationships with people like Hosni Mubarak or the Saudi royal family as one where they were our clients, and at the end of the day, we exercised a fair bit of control over what they did, but it's always a two-way relationship.
Yeah.
And I think in this is an example of one element of policy, but I think that there are others where displeasure and discomfort from the leader of an allied police state or authoritarian state, ultimately trumped what was the advice of most of, I think, the Foreign Service who was engaged in the question, though there were also debates within the national security bureaucracy. There was a sense, I quoted a guy named Harold Rode, who for years was an analyst of political Islam at the Office of Net Assessment in the Pentagon and was one of the greatest champions inside the government of Ahmad Shalabi in the 1990s. He was
sort of the uber pessimist in the article.
Most of the folks who would end up meeting with the U.S. could say that they figured out how to say what we wanted to hear. And I interviewed other people like Ed Derizian, who was a former Assistant Secretary of State, who, if you read his speech from 1991 or 1992 at the Meridian Center, mm-hmm. 1991, I guess, it sounds almost exactly like what Obama said in his Cairo speech, which is trying to formulate this bargain where the United States says, we will engage you, we won't object to you joining the political process, but you need to let us know that you're not going to pull in Algeria, yeah. Where the Islamist Party in 1991 said that democracy was not compatible with Islam, or to do what Ayatollah Khomeini did, which is, you know, at first say that he was interested in, you know, governing through a kind of coalition, and then, you know, we know what happened in Iran.
I mean, the thing I was struck by reading the piece, Eli, and it's, you know, it's very well researched, and I have to say, maybe this is just me, it was really breathtaking to read that kind of story, and you didn't have a single anonymous source.
Thank you.
I was actually really impressed. I mean, everyone you had, you know, went on the record, and admittedly, because I don't know if you talked to current administration officials, but it was really quite pleasant to read.
I did have one anonymous for the current administration stuff. I mean, I think anonymous sources tend to be more necessary when you're covering a current policy debate. And I was trying to look at a broader sweep of things.
But anyway,
because as you know, as an academic.
Yes.
There are very few really new problems.
This is
true. Very rarely does a problem present itself that we've never had to think about before.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking, after the events in Cairo and the events in Egypt where I'd lived, I was thinking, and I'd covered a lot of congressional hearings where State Department officials like James Steinberg would get beaten up by like members of Congress saying, are you going to allow the Muslim Brotherhood to participate in the government that replaces Mubarak? And I remember thinking, this is kind of an absurd question because the Muslim Brotherhood participates in so many aspects of daily life. And
that's one of those classic questions that sort of massively overestimates U.S. power. I mean, I'm willing to acknowledge that I think there are times where I think the Obama administration has actually underestimated its own influence and circumstances, but that's one of those things where it just assumes, well, surely we get to pick Egypt's new government, right? Because, I mean, it's going to be a democracy.
Right.
And since we're the head democracy, we get to pick, you know, because that's fully consistent with democracy. So.
Well, right. But then what I thought was that like these questions were just, they didn't articulate it, but there was this central problem, which is that what they were really worried about was if the Muslim Brotherhood participates and agrees they're only going to contest 30% of the seats, they're not going to run a candidate for the presidency,
yeah.
Will they eventually try to take over a fragile, what we hope to be a more democratic or open system that emerges in this transition period, and then turn Egypt into an Islamic republic?
Right.
And, you know, I guess I came away after talking to lots of people where I didn't know the answer to that question. And I, you know, also talked to people in the Muslim Brotherhood, and I guess as a reporter, I'm lucky I don't have to come up with a policy, but I think that that's the central challenge that the Obama administration is facing. And I do think that behind the scenes, they are engaged on this question, but I think that it's perilous for them to publicly say that they want to support parties and factions that are that they would consider to be more moderate and more accommodating of a pluralistic system.
No, I would tend to agree. I mean, the thing that struck, I would say two things. First, you know, reading your piece, the thing that struck me was, to what extent are you actually going to have variation in the strength and, for that matter, the ideology of these Islamist groups across countries? Because, I mean, you know, again, and I'm not an area expert on this, you know, I'm just, you know, reading what I can, but it struck me that the Egyptian variant of the Muslim Brotherhood, particularly since they renounced violence in the 90s, seems relatively speaking to be, you know, about as compatible, I guess, with democracy, with sort of Western liberal democracy, as you could hope this kind of group would be.
Right.
It might be the case that there would be different Islamist groups in other, you know, parts of the Middle East that, if there were to be these kinds of overthrows and democratizations and elections, would be less friendly. So, I mean, one of the issues that I kept coming away with was, I suppose it depends on which Muslim Brotherhood or which Islamist group you're engaging. With respect,
that's absolutely right.
Yeah.
You raise a couple of things there that I think I just want to unpack for a second.
Mm-hmm.
That I just want, because there's a lot of misinformation out there on the Muslim Brotherhood. One is that experts, and I mean counterterrorism experts in the FBI, still don't know basic questions about what the international Muslim Brotherhood is.
No.
We know a lot about the Indonesian Muslim Brotherhood. We know a lot about the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. But we don't know what the connection is between these various branches, and then a kind of larger international shura of Muslim Brotherhood. Are they there to kind of assist and fund things? Are they a network of businesses? Do they don't? It doesn't appear that they make a kind of consistent policy for all the Muslim Brotherhood chapters. And let me just give a real basic example of that. In Iraq, Tariq al-Hashimi, who was the vice president in the last administration, was the leader of the Iraqi Muslim Brotherhood, or the equivalent of the Iraqi Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And he was participating, according to the Jordanian and Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, in what they considered to be an occupation government that it was justifiable to take up arms against. So the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt had a policy of rhetorical support for, the what they called the resistance in Iraq, which I think the U.S. Americans would call terrorists in Iraq. Yet the Muslim Brotherhood in Iraq was participating in a government that was trying to arrest and kill those terrorists that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt considered to be a resistance.
Right. So, I mean, that's what I mean.
So that would augur against the idea that there is a kind of central policy planning committee right. for all the chapters of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's very relevant for something I didn't get into in my piece, but is relevant to what you would read, I think, in some criticism on the right about how the International Muslim Brotherhood has groups in the United States like the Council of American Islamic Relations, based on a document called the Holy Land Foundation memo that was made public in a case against a charity that was raising money for, I think it was Hamas. Mm-hmm. And it's true that this document says that the goal of setting up lots of organizations in the United States was to create a civilizational jihad or an alternative,
right.
a soft sort of dawah to make America a more Islamic country. But it's unclear what that I don't know in any way that this document proves that there's sort of a secretive international cabal of the Muslim Brotherhood internationally that's pulling the strings of these American organizations.
There's no Muslim
Just
version.
I wouldn't say that that's the case for the Indonesian chapter or any other.
Right. In other words, what we're saying is there's no Muslim version of the Comintern or, you know, the sort of centralized kind of organization you would have with the Catholic Church.
Well, let me just caveat that, okay. And I hate to be wishy-washy, but as a reporter, I get to not have to make definitive judgments. Mm-hmm. I stress that it's not known because it's fairly secretive. And you get different answers depending on who. I think there's definitely an international fundraising network,
right?
Without a doubt, that can move money around. I don't know that there's an internet. I think you're right. I think that's right. That I don't think there's an international commenter exactly that sets policy in that way. But there is some internet. There is an international organization of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. It's very unclear exactly the full extent of what it does.
And it'll be interesting to see if, you know, I mean, one of the interesting questions will be as these groups actually do acquire some kind of either, not even necessarily political power, but at least political voice or greater voice in their countries, whether you're going to start to see these groups cohere more or fracture. My bet would be fracture just because you've got different national interests depending upon the country, but that'll be an interesting question going forward. On Egypt, though, I just wanted to say on your point there, I agree with you that the last thing the Obama administration wants to do is sort of come out vocally and say, oh, we support these parties, but not these parties, you know, in
right.
the voice going forward, because basically that's like, you know, a dog whistle to all, you know, saying, oh, the ones we oppose, those are the ones we should support. I think, you know, the fear that you talk about, I think the concern that what's happening right now in Iran or what's happening in Egypt right now is akin to what, let's say, was happening in Iran, not in 79, but in 78, when you had, you know, a lot of different groups rising up and protesting the Shah for very justifiable reasons. And then in the end, you had this sort of patchwork of different groups that in the end the Islamists wound up triumphing over. I think I'm more optimistic. That's obviously, that could happen. I'm not going to deny that. I mean, anything can happen. But the way that Egypt has played out, at least to date, suggests that that's probably not going to happen. In a number of ways, which is first, the Egyptian military is still remains a coherent, you know, both political and you know, military fighting force in a way that the Iranian military was not respected in the same way in the late 70s.
Right.
And also, second, it doesn't look, I mean, first of all, it doesn't look like they're going to be able to return back to sort of pre-Mubarak falling in the sense of, you know, you've had further resignations. And you did not have a great day yesterday, but, you know, in the sense that there was a women's protest and there was a lot of harassment going on in Tahrir Square.
Right.
And I believe you also had some religious conflict in Muslims attacking Christians. So, I mean, those do not necessarily augur well. on the other hand, you do see what seems to be a relatively orderly process in terms of creating an election. And you also have a Muslim Brotherhood, as you said, that recognizes, at least at a minimum, that if it tries to make an ambitious power grab right now, that would be, you know, it would be self-defeating for itself.
Right.
So in that sense, at a minimum, this is going to be a much more slower motion process in terms of how things, you know, play out going forward. And it also looks like you've got a clear, you know, at least something in the way of a clear frontrunner in Amr Moussa, who's now currently the Secretary General of the Arab League.
He's not...
would you say he's a frontrunner or
don't
not?
Don't be fooled. Amr Moussa is no moderate.
Say that again?
Amr Moussa is a lunatic. All right? There, I said it.
He's a what? I'm sorry.
He's a lunatic. I've covered him. Okay. Amr Moussa is not somebody who I think would be ending up as a moderate voice. I don't know that he would be somebody who the West would. I mean, at the end of the day, he's not an Ayatollah. He's not an Islamic leader.
Right.
And I also think he would be something like an Egyptian Hugo Chavez in that if
That's
he was
good.
The president of Egypt, I think you would see Egypt steered closer to what's called the resistance bloc of Syria, Turkey, and Iran.
Although, you know,
it
was interesting.
Amr Moussa has a very secular profile in Egyptian society.
Right. The other thing that was interesting, I was actually surprised that he did this. I read that he was giving a, you know, he had an open town hall, I think, yesterday that was covered in the Times. And the thing that surprised me is that he basically said, you know, he was pushed to say, don't recognize Israel and, you know, what about the United States? And his basic response was, look, it's a reality we got to deal with Israel, and, you know, we want to be friends with the United States, which, as you said, was not something that, based on what Moussa had said in the past, I would have expected him to say, particularly in that venue. So that was at least pleasantly surprising, although maybe, you know, do you think that's just a tactic, a stalling tactic?
There was a song that was very popular in Egypt about 10 years ago, the title of which was, I Hate Israel, But I Love
Moussa.
Moussa.
Yes, I heard about this. That's what got him fired.
I want to pick up on two things.
Yeah.
One is, what do the Islamists want? And if you go back and you read your Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood, he believed that West, with all of its temptations, was turning away Muslims from the true faith of Islam. And that if you removed the imperial presence, both culturally and physically, like the monarchy of Egypt in the first half of the 20th century, then Muslims would naturally find the enlightenment of true Islam. That was his belief. And I guess if you look at the kind of longer trajectory of Egyptian society, Gamal Abdel Nasser was certainly an anti-Western and anti-American and anti-Israel figure. He started two wars against Israel, and in that respect would be seen as an irritant. But he oriented his society as a kind of secular Arab socialism.
Right.
But after Nasser, first with Anwar Sadat, ironically, who was murdered by kind of radical Islamists that had broken away from the Muslim Brotherhood, you see Anwar Sadat changing the Egyptian constitution to say that the Quran is a source of law, which is a major deal for the Muslim Brotherhood. They believe that this is something that they can exploit, that they don't need to amend the constitution in Egypt. And the second thing is that over time, people like Hosni Mubarak that the United States believed was the secular alternative to the Muslim Brotherhood or the secular alternative to political Islam. In Hosni Mubarak's Egypt in 2008, a blogger was sentenced and sent to jail for insulting the Prophet. Now, under the Taliban, we call that blasphemy, but it's happening in Egypt.
Hmm.
And he recently has encouraged, I mean, Mubarak in his last couple of years encouraged Salafi satellite stations, which is a more ascetic version of Islam that kind of is the theological antecedent to what we might call kind of Al-Qaeda's theology, if that's what you want to call it. So a lot of times, and we saw that not just with Hosni Mubarak, in the case of Yasser Arafat, you know, after the Camp David talks, he creates something called the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade.
Right.
Well, okay, these are the people who are ostensibly not Islamists, but they are doing things that certainly are accommodating the kind of broader political agenda. And I think that this has happened throughout the Middle East, and that we're going to see that there was an Islamic awakening under the very noses of the ostensibly secular dictatorships that we thought were the alternatives to political Islam.
Well, it's worth remembering. I mean, the one hard fact I remember about, you know, studying Middle East politics was that as you said, in some ways, the Islamic awakening was actually encouraged by these authoritarian states,
right.
In large part because in the 60s and 70s, what these authoritarian leaders were worried about was not an Islamic challenge to their authority, but rather a leftist challenge to their authority.
Right.
And so they kind of shut down. They were, you know, in other words, in the 60s and 70s, they were perfectly willing to repress those the left groups and then reward these other groups, which they thought were more pliant. In some ways, you know, what Musharraf did, for example, in Pakistan about a decade ago was the same. Was coming from the same playbook. So I think I do.
Or General Zia al-Huq was a kind of, he's a military leader, but he was definitely an Islamist.
So I do think one of the interesting things that will happen going forward is if you wind up opening up a political space where, you know, there's at least a greater range of opinions that can be voiced. What I do wonder is whether part of the reason that you have the popularity of these Islamist groups was that at the time they were the best symbol of opposition to these authoritarian leaders in the first place, even though, as you said and I acknowledge, in some ways they were tacitly supported at various points by these governments. So, in other words, if you eliminate that, and so they're not the only opposition, will they maintain as much popular support? And I think, let's face it, these are unknown questions at this point. It's going to be, you know,
I think that's exactly the right. I think it's important to make is that for the Muslim Brotherhood, and there is a split, and for the real scholars, I'm probably glossing over, but generally speaking, there's a split among people who are proponents of political Islam. There are the people who follow Sayyid Qutb, who was a Muslim Brotherhood ideologue. Yeah. Essayist, and who believed in political violence against the near regimes, and that's where you get Al-Qaeda.
And was very opposed to church dances in Wisconsin, if memory serves, or Colorado, I can't remember.
And then there's the rest of the mainstream Muslim Brotherhood that believed they could accomplish the goal of creating Islamic societies and Islamic states through dawah, or what is sort of proselytization, by appealing and persuading fellow Muslims to turn to the right way. And that project of dawah in Egypt and these other countries kind of continued, even though the groups at times faced great persecution. And I think that a combination of things has led to the fact that we're dealing with a more Islamic Middle East, if that makes any sense. There was a period probably in the middle of the 20th century where you could say that Ataturk was the wave, that had a lot of these rulers looking to the West to model their societies. Today, I think that they're looking to Islam. Even in the case of the ostensibly secular dictatorships that appear to be falling right now, they made so many accommodations to this wave that was bigger than any one movement that when we see the kind of these regimes collapse, what we're going to find is more Islamic societies than we would have found 50 years ago.
I would close with this point, and this is actually a nice segue to our next topic, which is that I think you're probably right, at least right now. I think the interesting question is whether or not you see this sort of rise of Islamist groups as an inexorable wave or an inexorable embrace of these new set of ideas, or in fact, you know, as you have the rough and tumble of democracy, God willing, in these places, you might have a situation where these groups are going to wax and wane in power, where they might be more popular, but then they're actually, God forbid, responsible for governing. They don't do that great of a job. And then they wind up losing, and then they, wind up being more popular again as the next schmoes wind up being, equally incompetent.
Right.
So I think my hope is that I don't disagree with, if you take a snapshot of now compared with, let's say, 1970, I think you're absolutely right. I think the hope is that, the kind of political openings that you're seeing in these region, countries, if you actually have routinized, democratic procedures, it allows for these kinds of groups to wax, but also hopefully to wane. Because let's face it, no one is, automatically going to be great at governing there, which is a nice thing.
Hassan al-Banna, in the end, might be more influential than Kemal Ataturk.
Right. It's possible. But, I mean, that's actually a nice segue to...
It's a perfect segue, actually, because we're going to talk about the Tea Party and their foreign policy.
Right.
And I think the segue is like this.
Yeah.
Why in the world, given the fact that we've had all of this upheaval in Egypt... And because I think a part of this, U.S. influence with the Egyptian military and the Egyptian military's reliance on the U.S. military, the United States has a lot of leverage in what could have been a really unstable, disastrous situation for U.S. interests because of the relatively cheap price of, $1.6 billion a year?
Yeah.
So I think that the investment in Egyptian military aid, if you want to know why it's why you do it. It's because of times like this when the caretaker government is essentially the military. And the U.S. has so much leverage because of how complex the spare parts and the equipment that, you know, needs constant maintenance. Mm-hmm. And that gives the United States a lot of leverage with the people who are overseeing this transition in Egypt that had there been no military aid like that, they would not have had. So, I mean, I would just say, so to me, from my perspective, who covers it like at this level, it's really odd that now would be the time you would find people like Rand Paul and other elements of a wing of the Tea Party saying they don't like foreign and military aid like that.
Well, I would say two things. First of all, I think you're absolutely correct. I think one of the missing points and one of the sort of big takeaway points is that it's not a coincidence, I think, that the militaries that have had a relatively tighter relationship with the U.S. military in the Middle East have by and large been restrained in response to these kinds of uprisings. I mean, as you said, it's right, Egypt could have ended in a much more horrible fashion. Imagine what's happening in Libya, but in Egypt. You know, right. I mean, Libya, it's bad in Libya, but Egypt, you're talking about the center of the Middle East, and the loss of life there could have been calamitous. I agree with you. It's not a coincidence that, you know, the U.S. Leverage over the Egyptian military probably, you have to assume, played at least a somewhat pivotal role in preventing.
Yeah. I mean, Field Marshal Tantawi also, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not taking away from him. I'm just saying that the Egyptian military is actually amazingly a trusted institution in this period where everything else in Egyptian society is being exposed for the kind of corrupt fraudulence that it was. And that is happens to be the one sort of nexus of the U.S.-Egyptian relationship that is the strongest.
Yeah. As to why
the military
now, as to why the Tea Party wouldn't necessarily, or the Tea Party movement wouldn't care about that, I mean, I think there's a couple things here. The first is that, you know, again, it's worth pointing out, and this is in response to the lead essay in Foreign Affairs is by Walter Russell Mead, which sort of examines the Tea Party in American foreign policy. And, of course, it being Walter Russell Mead, you've got to go back to, you know, the 1790s to
I love it.
Yeah, to talk about the intellectual roots. You know, I mean, in some ways, Mead sort of takes updates Special Providence, which is his great 2001 book, to the Tea Party. I think the answer to why, I mean, there's two reasons. The first is that a very large block of the Tea Party, and, you know, he calls it the Paulite, and I think that's a fair way. I think Glenn Beck would also, by the way, fit into this wing. You know, a large group that is A, libertarian, and B, profoundly suspicious of the rest of the world. So libertarian in the sense of they don't like the federal government, but also nationalist in the sense that they don't like everyone else who's not an American either. So, you know, in some ways, what's happening in Egypt, they either don't care or see it, if you're in Glenn Beck world, as part of this, you know, movement to start the caliphate again. So, I mean, I agree with you that in many ways Egypt has been a policy success for the United States and a triumph for the virtues of U.S. foreign aid during moments of crisis. So I agree with you completely on that. But in some ways that's a subtle point that escapes a large part of the Tea Party. The second point I would make, and this is the point of a blog post I did in response to Mead, is that I'm increasingly coming to the conclusion that it doesn't matter what the Tea Party thinks about foreign policy for a couple of reasons. First, as Mead notes, and I think this is correct, the Tea Party has a set of mutually contradictory views on foreign policy. There is the, you know, Paulite wing, which is sort of not isolationist in the sense of it doesn't want U.S. to really engage with multilateral institutions, to engage, you know, in terms of the use of force abroad, wants, you know, American troops home. You know, and that there's a long intellectual Jeffersonian lineage that, you know, is perfectly appropriate. You know, you can call it isolationist without it necessarily having the pejorative sense that word carries with it. The other wing, which is closely associated with Sarah Palin, is, you know, sort of a more Jacksonian triumphalist belief. Same suspicion of multilateral institutions, but in this case, the way I would describe it as the foreign policy is similar to Charlie Sheen's answer, which is winning. You know, the notion that America must win, you know, at all costs, anywhere, everywhere in the world. So that group might be a little more enthusiastic about what's happening in Egypt, although, again, they would, you know, they might be a little more wary of the Muslim Brotherhood. But the point is that those groups disagree with each other, and therefore the notion that they're going to somehow put that disagreement aside and carry out a common and mutual foreign policy position, you know, in dealing with everyone else, I think is kind of absurd. The only ways I think those two groups have any kind of commonality on foreign policy is first on suspicion of multilateral institutions, so that will they will matter there. And second, yep. on, for lack of a better way of putting it, sort of American cultural nationalism. This belief that, you know, and this goes to the hearings that Peter King's about to hold on, you know, the role right. of Muslim groups in the United States and, you know, illegal immigration across the Mexican border. Both wings will oppose the, you know, will oppose illegal immigration or, for that matter, you know, potentially a lot of legal immigration, and will be, you know, relatively supportive of the notion that we want to guard against, you know, Muslims taking over the United States. But the other thing,
the new Tea Party choice for national anthem is exactly. Tina Turner's "Simply the Best."
There you go. Yes, okay. or you know the you've seen the Team America movie, right?
Yeah, America.
America. Yeah. Yeah. Beep, yeah. So anyway, right. But the,
well, I, first of all, yeah. I love Walter Russell Mead, and I actually thought I ended up agreeing with your point because Russell Mead's point was that they could block. Key, you know, appointments to ambassadorships in the Senate, and they could use the power of a minority to hold up various foreign policies and to sort of to go out of their way.
Yeah.
And I think that that's true if they were motivated primarily by foreign policy. And I think that, like, if the Tea Party movement had coalesced in, say, 2006, you would see more of a kind of victory voter as a backlash to the move-on stuff and, yeah. and the anti-war sentiment. But we're in a different moment right now, and in that respect, I think that you're right that their primary thing is the debt.
Yeah.
I think they're just absolutely frustrated with the debt, and they want to shrink the government, and they don't want to raise taxes, and these are their priorities. And you know, foreign policy can kind of work itself out.
Right.
And they certainly, I mean, I don't think anyone really has had much of a coherent response to the events that are happening in the Middle East right now that are so, you know, momentous, but you haven't really heard like a Tea Party kind of coherent critique of that, which I think augurs for your argument that this stuff is just not as important as these other things.
Right. I don't think it's important, and I also don't think there can be a coherent Tea Party response. Not to say I think there can be a coherent response by a member of the Tea Party, which is to say the Paulite version would be it's none of our concern, we don't have to worry about it, or you know, there's the more maximalist wing, which would say, you know, we've got to have, you know, which would be, going back to your hearing questions, why aren't we influencing Egypt to make sure the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't win? But those two can't combine, so therefore they're not going to be the sort of effective veto bloc that Mead talks about. But the second thing I would argue, and this might be a more controversial proposition, is I think the Tea Party has peaked as a political movement, which, you know, I know is heresy in D.C., but you know, you take a look at the polling on this, and you're starting to see signs of ebbing, for lack of a better way of putting it, about anger about the U.S. government. Now, part of this, I think, is because the Tea Party had a successful midterm election. So in some ways, they're more comfortable with government now because there are more Tea Party members of Congress. So that's part of it. But I think the other interesting thing is that the sort of leading lights of the Tea Party movement, namely Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin, have actually become less popular in the last year rather than more popular. So I think this is one of those, you know, I think Sam Huntington would call it creedal passion moments, where it's peaked and where the moment these people actually have to make hard political choices, not just on foreign policy, but also on questions like the debt and taxes, you know, they're going to start squabbling the same way that, you know, the Reform Party of Ross Perot started squabbling. Actually, it's worse because these guys actually have real power. So,
well, but I guess I don't think it's I saw that analogy and I don't think it's exactly right because
okay.
they're not a third party.
That's
they're
true.
In the Republican Party for now.
Yeah.
They could be a third party, but it doesn't look like that necessarily is going to happen. Sarah Palin may, I mean, I'm not going to predict what she's going to do, but it looks to me like it's certainly plausible that she's going to remain something of a kind of media personality
yeah.
and a cultural celebrity, but not actually run for president.
You know, what I think Sarah Palin is turning into? I just realized. She's like the right version of Camille Paglia.
Really?
Think about it. I mean, Camille Paglia.
I kind of count Camille Paglia on the right a little bit.
Actually, you're true. The right, Camille Paglia is the right version of Camille Paglia. But in some ways, she's like
yeah.
that. You know, she's this sort of gadfly who quote, you know, who talks about the things she wants to talk about. But that's pretty much it. You know, when it came to Palin, I was very proud because I said last year there was no chance she was running. But now I'm worried because she's actually becoming increasingly unpopular. And now a lot of people in D.C. are acknowledging that she's probably not going to run. So now I think she might actually run just out of spite.
Well, okay, and that's certainly a possibility. I think that she wants to make it seem like she's maybe could run.
Yeah, she might pull
as
a Cuomo.
As long as possible, because that's right. That's financially beneficial for her
and
family.
No, she'll pull like a Mario Cuomo, and like right up until the New Hampshire deadline, we'll play with it. Yeah.
But I guess if she doesn't run, let's assume, I don't know, let's say she doesn't run, there will be a nominee for the Republicans, and you know we'll have to see who that person is. But the real test to find out the influence of the Tea Party, since they're not a third party, I would say would be what that Republican nominee or front runner who becomes kind of the leader of the party going into the 2012 cycle, whether they adopt the themes of small government, reducing the debt, no taxes that the Tea Party has talked about, and whether they adopt the sort of we have to keep cutting the government attitude, or whether they decide to run their campaign on some other themes. And I think that's how in the end we'll measure the influence of the Tea Party. And then finally, though I think in some ways it is too soon to say, around that individual who will be the Republican nominee, you will find key individuals who will be advisors and people who would, if they won, be expected to fill senior positions in the new government. Do those individuals have ties or connections to the Tea Party? So I think that in that respect, the jury's still out, because I think to understand the impact of the Tea Party, it's something that's going to be determined within, for now at least, the Republican Party. It's possible that Glenn Beck will say that, you know, he had a conversation with God or whoever, and he's going to run himself, or he's going to support another third-party candidate.
Oh, that would be awesome. Then, I so want Glenn Beck to run for president. That would be friggin' fantastic. I mean, come on, you know, because A, he won't win, and B, it would be like your classic sort of meltdown. It would be the political equivalent of Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, I have to say I haven't watched the show really that much. And when I have seen stuff, it's been on the internet. But what he said, his version of history, is so flawed and kind of prone to conspiracy views that it saddens me, because he's had on serious authors who I like very much, like Amity Schles, who wrote The Forgotten Man, and he's had serious people on his show to discuss issues at one point, but he seems to have gotten kind of crazier and crazier and crazier.
Well, I mean, yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. And I think one of the most interesting things, sort of developments within the GOP now, is that you're seeing right-wing, you're seeing like Pete Wenner and Bill Kristol basically just flat out saying Beck is crazy and he's bad for conservatism, which is not something that I think would have been said. To some extent, David Frum was saying it in early 2009, but he was sort of the only one who was talking about it back then.
When David Frum did the cover story for Newsweek on Rush Limbaugh, it was, you know, the party establishment considered that to be an act of treachery.
Right, heresy,
treason.
You know, yeah.
And he was in many ways excommunicated.
Yeah.
David, full disclosure, is a really good friend of mine, so I should make that very clear. I think, though, that in some ways David was just like maybe a year and a half too soon, because you're right. You are seeing a lot of mainstream Republican and conservative figures that are saying kind of, cool this down, this is crazy talk. I would also, though, distinguish between what Glenn Beck says and then the Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levin, Sean Hannity, whereas you can disagree with it, you can think it's unrealistic, you can think they are not fairly describing the problem, but it doesn't really veer into the same kind of conspiracy stuff that Beck does. It's just not the same.
No, it's fair. In that sense, I think Limbaugh and Levin, you know, based on what I see, you know, engage in casual falsehoods, I guess would be the way to put it. But no, they don't have the sort of same paranoid, it lacks the sort of sense of overarching menace, I guess, that someone like Beck does.
Well, I should say, I listen to Mark Levin every now and again. Yeah. I think that there are times when he can be really an articulate spokesman for conservative values. And his book is it's not really a critique of Obama, because he wrote it before Obama. It's a critique of, he wants to bring back Goldwater conservatism, Reagan conservatism, he says it. And when he talks about those issues, he's very good. I think that he's also, the format of talk radio, it's kind of like listening to his show is a bit like anger theater. So you're waiting for the moment that you know is coming when he just loses it and starts just, you know, calling out all the libs and the socialists and everybody else around him. And that, I think, does have a cathartic effect for his audience. And it is a form of it's engaging. I don't want to say it's just entertainment, because I think he's I think there are a lot of, I think he's got a serious political program. I can't discern what Glenn Beck's serious program is. That's the problem for me, is that I don't, like, what is it that Glenn Beck would have us do that isn't totally nuts? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I think we'd cry a little bit, and then we, you know.
Right.
I mean, I have to say, I am prejudiced by the fact that I've only seen Glenn Beck a couple of times, and I am profoundly jealous of Glenn Beck. Because basically, this guy, all he does is talk to the camera, go to blackboards, and write stuff down. I am paid to do that for a living, but I am not paid nearly as much as Glenn Beck, you know? So, it sets up bad incentives. You know, every once in a while, I think, maybe I should start talking about conspiracies. Yeah, that's the way to get on, you know. But it's a bad, that's a bad place that I go to, and I've got to stop doing that.
Well, let me just...
Sorry, go ahead.
Really quickly, before we have to go, I wanted to address one thing in the Walter Russell Mead essay, which is worth reading, I hope. You know,
yeah, no, it is, I agree.
But, and that is that he addresses this issue of the international order and the liberal international order as something that he doesn't get into, like, I wish he would have acknowledged that there is a somewhat legitimate critique of the current liberal international order. And I guess I'm just a journalist here, but I would put myself in the category, Dan, as somebody who would like to see a functioning liberal international order headed by the United States. So in that camp, I guess I'm out of the sort of, you know, Jacksonian crowd. But I'm also I look at the international system, and particularly the UN system, and I say, based on, you know, the rules or the goals that liberal internationalists have sort of criticized the Bush approach, I don't think that the UN really lives up to it, and I think that there's some serious flaws there that, you know, Bush failed to address, John Bolton failed to address, and that it's still a problem for the UN. And I think that there's a very legitimate space for this critique of saying, I want a good liberal international order, but the current liberal international order is really hindered by the institutions that were set up after World War II to keep it in check, so to speak.
All right, I'd give a response, and we should switch to the Dollars for Scholars thing.
Okay.
But I would say the following, two things. First of all, focusing on the UN, I mean, the UN, in some ways it's a cheap shot. The true sort of, I guess, international relations type liberals, you know, that would think about international order. When you think about the international order, the UN is maybe fifth or sixth on the list of institutions that matter. So the ones that you care about are in some ways the ones that actually have real power. I mean, the Security Council matters. There's no doubt about that. And that's in some ways the one where you can point to it being significant. You know, things like the Human Rights Council, which are the easiest things to caricature as, you know, mockeries of the international order, don't really matter all that much. I mean, they matter in a rhetorical sense, but otherwise not that much. The key institutions that matter are, you know, the G20, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Basel, you know, the Bank of International Settlements, the Financial Stability Board, the OECD, then the sort of regional organizations. Those are the groups that really matter. Now, that said, your critique isn't still necessarily wrong, because you can argue that those institutions work, generally speaking, a lot more efficiently than the UN has, and have also, by the way, been dominated by the United States to a much greater extent, at least in the past.
Yep.
The problem is that going forward... Oh, and the WTO, I forgot about the World Trade Organization.
Right.
The problem is that going forward, these institutions do appear... There's a problem that there's a genuine shift in the distribution of power. I mean, you talk about an American-led order, and, you know, I'd like that too. I also want free ponies. So the question is whether that's possible in a world where U.S. relative power is at least on the decline. Say that that's a terminal decline, a la Fareed Zakaria, it's just a decline. The question is whether those institutions can manage to still function in a world that at least looks somewhat more multilateral. And I think in some ways the most disconcerting part of this is not so much the U.S. decline, it's the fact that key U.S. supporters, namely European allies and Japan, are declining at an even more rapid rate. And so that makes things really difficult. So I don't disagree that that's a challenge. I think focusing on the UN, though, is the wrong way to do it. I think the question you have to ask is, how can these other, you know, the sort of economic institutions, the ones that really, really matter, but also, I mean, there are security ones, the Security Council, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and so forth. You know, how do you strengthen those in a situation where the U.S. isn't quite as influential as it was 20 years ago?
Well, the Non-Proliferation Treaty is a great example of a very important thing that we want a liberal international order to handle.
Right. But hasn't but there have been obviously massive problems.
It hasn't been doing a good job at.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily say that's because the NPT is a bad idea because it puts unfair restraints on American nuclear hegemony. No, I like the NPT. What I don't like is that there has been this problem with dealing with clearly bad actors in the system, which is the United States and the international community tends to look at the problem of Iran on the NPT as what can we do to make them live up to this NPT, which they're not living up to, and God forbid if they withdrew from the treaty. But I think another way to look at it is their participation in the treaty, or their when we recognize that they're still in the treaty and they have the rights of other nuclear nations, we are in some ways weakening the credibility of the treaty and the IAEA and the international system to deal with a very serious problem of rogue nuclear proliferation. And I would just point out that I love Ali Hainonen. There are a lot of very, very smart people at the IAEA, but the IAEA did not stop or bring down the AQCON network. That was something that was done through British and U.S. intelligence diplomacy with Libya, and ultimately through these institutions that are somewhat out of the kind of established international system. So nuclear proliferation is one example. There are a couple other examples that I would point out as well, where I just think that I'd like to see a liberal international order that is dealing with these problems, but I think it's stuck.
Let me put it this way. Those are valid points, and again, it's easy to point even to the economic institutions and say that they haven't worked perfectly either. I think the question becomes, when is the perfect the enemy of the good? Which is to say, if you want to say there's got to be a way to improve the NPT, I don't necessarily disagree with that. The question is whether there is a feasible way of doing it where you can get buy-in from other countries, because there's no way that you can just have a unilateral U.S. announcement of we're going to shift things. There used to be that. I just simply don't think the U.S. is quite as powerful as it used to be on that front. So that option isn't open, which then leaves the frustrating question of what do you do in those circumstances. And I think the answer is, and this is why I think, in the end, even though liberal internationalism is the de facto U.S. foreign policy, it's never terrifically popular within the foreign policy community, because it is very easy to point out the flaws that you have just pointed out. Compared to domestic governments, it never is going to work as well. Because each of these countries has sovereignty. And so, oddly enough, I think the only way you have truly effective global governance is by having countries cede sovereignty that they don't want to do. So this will, in some ways, this is a unsolvable problem going forward until you have enough sort of mutual trust that you're actually willing to create these kinds of institutions with teeth. And unfortunately, those don't exist in most dimensions of world politics.
Okay, well, with a very little bit of amount of time we have, you wrote, I think your latest post on the blog was called International Scholars for Dollars.
Right, and this
and
is...
And it dealt with Libya.
Yeah, so that, you know...
And I was on Twitter last week, and someone named Anthony Lowenstein, who's a far-left kind of critic of the West and Israel, kind of wrote something on, you know how Twitter is, it's like, it's 140 characters or less, about Tony Blair... sucking up to Gaddafi, and isn't this terrible?
Yeah.
And I wrote back, because I thought about this, like, would you rather that Libya had, like, a nuclear program that could be looted right now in the middle of a civil war? I mean, it's bad enough that they have stocks of mustard gas that could get into the wrong hands. Would you rather that, the U.S. didn't cut that deal? I mean, I'm just saying, I don't like Muammar Gaddafi. I want Libya to be more democratic. And I'd like to see the U.S. try to advantage the rebels in that country. But none of that augurs against the fundamental deal that was made in the end of 2003 that disarmed a potentially dangerous sponsor of international terrorism from obtaining nuclear weapons, right?
I mean, this is interesting in that, what you're talking about is, again, a sort of classic divide between, sort of short-term realpolitik policy measures versus sort of long-term focusing on the quality of the regime rather than who's in charge. And I think this is one of those moments where realists have a relatively strong, position to say, you can argue that what's happening now is not great, but, even knowing what's happening now, do you go back and make that deal in 2003? Every time you make that deal. for precisely the reasons you said. You know, that is, even if the deal temporarily empowered Gaddafi within Libya, you still get nuclear weapons out of this guy. And indeed, the behavior of him over the last 6 months, you know, the last 6 weeks suggests, yes, if anything, you do anything possible to get, you know, weapons of mass destruction out of him.
In addition to a star intelligence witness against the AQ Khan network.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I guess my view of it is that I think at the end of the day, it's a good thing for the world that Muammar Gaddafi hopefully will lose grip of Libya, hopefully. And I think that there's a very strong case, not necessarily for a no-fly zone. I don't know enough about the specifics of the military logistics of it, but just the notion that, you know, the U.S. should try to advantage the rebels at this point, I think is, and not just the U.S., the West, the world should advantage the rebels, is probably a good principle moving forward. But I just, you know, I mean, I just think in that situation, it's not a contest. I mean, just as I would say, even though I've been very tough on Iran, like, if you had a chance to legitimately disarm the Iranians,
you'd take
probably
that deal.
Take it because it's such a serious problem.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that the Iranians... I don't think there is such a chance diplomatically to do that, but I'm just saying that if there was, you do it.
No, I don't disagree. I mean, in some way, my post was about something slightly different, which was to say...
Yes. No. Well, let's get into your post. Your post was about internet IR scholars getting free trips out to Tripoli and...
Well, more than that, getting consulting money. I mean, basically, after the 2003 deal, you know, the Libyan elite started trying to reach out and find ways to normalize relations with the West. And this took... multiple forms, but the two most prominent ones recently was the fact that you had, you know, Sayyid al-Islam Gaddafi, you know, getting a PhD at the London School of Economics and promising a lot of money and support for both LSE and Oxford University Press and Oxford in return for publishing books. I think, among other things in the deal, you know, they were going to publish two of Gaddafi's books, and in return, Gaddafi was going to buy 20,000 copies of the book, which I guarantee you any university press would make that deal immediately. The second thing was the Monitor Group was hired by the Libyan government to basically burnish Libya's image in the West. And as part of that, a whole string of sort of very prominent scholars, you know, Bob Putnam, Benjamin Barber, Michael Porter, Joe Nye, Steve Walt, and others went out to Libya to meet at, you know,
Richard Pearl.
Right, to meet with either Gaddafi or his children, occasionally wrote up things about, you know, Libya might be an opportunity, although I think the if you read all of them, you know, Barber comes off as the most enthusiastic about these things, and others are far more circumspect in terms of their appraisal.
Right.
But this is obviously leading to one of these, you know, sort of classic questions of, oh, my God, how could these people take money and, you know, they're empowering dictators and so forth. And this, in some ways... you know, raises some really troubling ethical questions for scholars and for universities in the West, because, you know, Libya is in some ways a rare case. You actually have a lot of Western universities setting up satellite campuses and, you know, engaging in a fair amount of outreach in places in the world that are not democratic, you know, namely the Gulf Emirates, China, Russia, you know, you name it. I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. I think there are ways in which it can be ethically troubling, but... You know, that said, you can't just ignore the rest of the – just pretending we're not going to deal with those countries is, I think, you know, an example of lunacy. So that I don't think is much of an issue. Then with regard to the particular scholars, I think the point I made is that, you know, again, as you said, there did seem a moment in 2005 or 2006 where Libya really did want to integrate itself with the West. And this is precisely the moment where presumably you do want to send these people over as a way to see if these, you know, if the country and the government is actually open to change. I think where things...
Well, I actually would disagree.
Really?
I don't think Gaddafi ever was serious about democratically reforming his government. He's a classic demagogue.
Mm-hmm.
He really does believe that ridiculous green book of his is the most advanced, you know, political system you could come up with.
Yeah.
And I think that there was a... People like Ben Barber in particular were engaging a little bit of self-delusion.
Oh, yes.
And I say this as someone who loved Jihad versus McWorld when it came out in the 1990s.
Oh, really? Oh, God, I thought that was a crap book. I'm sorry.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I liked it because I liked how he summoned the data of things to measure kind of cultural influence. I thought that was really interesting, like the ticket sales of action movies and stuff like that. But
yeah, but that was the problem. In some ways, it was the most surface-level data you could possibly gather. It actually, I mean, in some ways, that was an example where he massively overestimated the influence of Western culture, because he only looked at things like movies and television. And so in that sense, I think he didn't realize, let's just put it this way. He sort of, culture is a much thicker stew than what he was talking about. I found that book ridiculously superficial.
All right. We disagree on that.
Yes.
I liked it, but then I'm probably a more superficial guy than you, Dan.
Now, I wrote a review in the Washington Quarterly of a lot of books, including that one, and I just wasn't terribly impressed with it. But to get back to Livia, I think you're right about Barber. Barber was sort of the one who held on the longest, and I think only resigned from this major board in late February, right, when it was obvious things were getting messy. I think what I don't blame are the academics that at least went over there to see what was going on, to see whether, in fact, Gaddafi was amenable to change. And then concluding that he wasn't, disengaged. I mean, I think this is what Michael Porter did, among others. And I don't think there's any problem with going over to finding... You might be right that Gaddafi was never going to change, but there were at least signs in the mid-2000s that maybe there was something going on. And I think that, I think it's worth it for the scholar to try to engage at that moment and to see whether or not, for lack of the technical term would be a plausibility probe, to go over there and see actually whether this is this change is real or whether it's in fact just, bullshit.
If I could, though, I want to single out one of those scholars.
Okay.
And you know who it's going to be. It's going to be Steve Wall.
Yeah.
Because Steve Wall, in his other writings, singles out the Israel lobby as this force that has distracted or taken the United States away from its core national interest. Mm-hmm. And one of the great flaws, as you pointed out in your original review of their essay, was that they didn't even mention the other actual lobbies that are influence peddling like every day in Washington, one of them being the Libyan government, but in at least as it concerns the peace process in Israel, the Libyan government has the same sort of agenda as the Saudis and the Gulf states, which pour tons of money into Washington and endow tons of university chairs and are incredibly influential. And it seems to me that as a general rule, the people who squawk loudest about the Israel lobby are probably usually connected in some ways to these other kinds of endowments. So in Walt's case, because he did accept the consulting fees or went over there and so forth, it's particularly delicious because he's got this whole theory about the Israel lobby.
I'm just going to let that go without
all right.
rebuttal.
Okay, I hear you because you guys are on the same blog.
No, it's not so much that. I think the interesting thing about Steve is why he went over when he did, which is, he only went over last year, and by that point it was pretty clear that Libya was not going to change. That said, I was never asked, but if I was asked, dear Dan, do you want to go over and see what Libya is like? Forget a consulting, assuming I wasn't getting a consulting fee, literally it's just part of the conference.
Yeah, I hear you.
I would have said yes, because I would have been curious. That I like going to places like that and seeing what's going on. I don't think the actual visit necessarily legitimates the regime.
As a reporter, I sometimes get offers to do these kind of trips that are supported, and I can't take them because if you take a gift like that from another government, then everything I would ever write about that government I would think would be questioned. So in that respect, my rule is you can't accept those sorts of junkets and expect to still be
objective.
Taken seriously journalist.
I think as an academic, I don't have to quite do that. What I think I have to do is acknowledge when I have, someone has paid for me to go somewhere or something like that. For example, Joe Nye wrote something in the New Republic where I think he was fully upfront, relatively speaking, about the fact that he was there at the behest of the Monitor Group and so on and so forth. And again, so long as you say that, you stated what your potential bias is, and then I don't think there's a real problem with it. I'm interested. I want to see. I don't necessarily have the last word on this. This is something that I think is going to be a problem going forward. If there's unrest in China, God knows how many Western universities have arrangements with universities in China.
So true.
So this is not a problem that's going to go away. And in some ways, I think Libya will be how Libya shakes out in terms of the academy will be an interesting test.
And
going
also,
forward.
Don't you think in the case of China that you have a situation where a lot of times access to government documents and archives are given to the scholars in the United States that are less critical.
Oh yeah, no, there was a great article I think in the Far East Economic Review a couple of years ago that made this point that if you're going to study an authoritarian country, Was it Janet Malcolm who said something about journalism is almost, you're always betraying your sources or something like that?
Yeah,
in some ways, if you try to study an authoritarian country, and to get access to that authoritarian country, you are engaging in a little bit of complicity. You have to choose just to how much complicity I think you're engaged in. So this is not something that Libya is going to resolve, but I like to see the debate because I'm curious what other people will think. So we'll take a look at the blog and its comments.
I would agree that, and here's the thing: it's like if you're if your specialty is like water engineering and you go to China to study their dams, then you're not expected as an academic because that's not your area.
Right. Yeah.
But I think it's the kind of broader kind of China specialists, and that it's greatly advantageous to somebody whose life work is studying China to have a good relationship with the current Chinese government, obviously. And so the scholars that have been critical of China have complained, and they've complained to me about not having that access.
Yeah. All right, well, with that, I think you have a lunch to go to, and I've got office hours to hold.
This was great.
A pleasure,
always
as always,
Eli. Thank you very much, Dr. Dre.
All right, take care.